How would you like to attend a conference and hear Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Al Schmidt? You're invited to the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. When the Pope goes someplace, the media will follow. Now, that really makes little difference. He could probably take a trip down to the store to buy bread, and it would make news. It certainly would make news. But when the Pope goes someplace as significant, politically and religiously, as the Middle East, it certainly makes headlines. But what kinds of headlines and stories have been written by the media as Pope Francis made his recent trip to the Middle East? He went there. Did the stories reflect the real reason for his visit? Did it reflect much of what he was doing there and the fact that he's there to commemorate the beginning of new relations with the other half of the historic Christian church, the Eastern Church? He's there as Church West to meet with Church East and to continue what happened 50 years ago when another pope met another patriarch from Orthodoxy, and they decided that maybe the schism of 1056, the Great Schism, should be over with. Joining us to talk about media coverage of Pope Francis' trip to the Middle East, Terry Mattingly, director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, author of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to talk to you again.
You peruse the papers, the big three, I would say, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post. What was the common thread that you found in their coverage of Francis's visit to the Middle East?
Well, I mean, you could talk about it in practical terms, what the stories were that they led with it, or you can jump straight to the philosophical. And today I think I'll go to the philosophical. Essentially, what ran through their coverage was that religion is really not that real. It's not a part of real life. That the Pope did not go to the Middle East for reasons that were essentially related to his ministry as the Bishop of Rome. He went there for reasons of politics, power, and statecraft in terms of demonstrating his power on the world stage in a troubled region. If you look at, you know, what they went with, over and over they focused on issues related to any symbolic gesture that he made that might be interpreted, and frankly should be interpreted, as a commentary on the state of Palestinians in the region. Of course, why is the Pope so interested, other than simple justice, why is he so interested in the Palestinians? Does it have anything to do that many of them in Bethlehem and elsewhere are Catholics or Orthodox or Christians? And he announced before going that one of his primary reasons to go to the region was to speak out on behalf of the religious liberty and the simple safety of Christians in the Middle East. Yet over and over we saw his actions interpreted in ways that made them purely attempts to interfere or to negotiate his way into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as opposed to symbolic actions on behalf of his own flock and the flock of others in the region. Once again, politics is real, religion isn't. Now, I dare say that most of our listeners, if they went back and looked at the coverage that caught their eye, especially on television, they would find it very hard to recall the specifics of anything uniquely religious or Christian that he said or did, which is another way of saying rarely does the media cover what the Pope actually says when he's on these trips. We get the symbolism of the actions, we get the photo ops, we get the statecraft, and then when you go back and read what he actually said, it's rather stunning how much of it is sermon material, how much of it is Christian, you know, about the specific biblical events of the places where he is and what they mean for believers today, and yes, what they may also suggest about life in our world today and even the tensions of the Middle East. But you're not going to see the scripture references, you know, in the pages of the major newspapers, sadly.
So you are saying that the primary reason for his visit was a story that the big three there didn't get. You found the AP coverage a little better. What did you find there?
Well, I mean, it's very important that we be honest about that word primary. I am not saying that what the Pope did in these other issues and these other symbolic events and stuff, I'm not saying that wasn't important. I'm also not saying that the foreign diplomats at the Vatican didn't plan all of those events with some sort of impact in mind. However, I would argue that a lot of the impact was meant to be on the church in that region, not just on the politics of that region. However, I mean, we historically know why the Pope was there. He was there because back when he was raised into the papacy in a very historic event, the ecumenical patriarch of the Orthodox churches of the East from Constantinople became the first patriarch in centuries to actually attend the installation rites for a pope. And at that event, he said, I would like you, in about a year, to meet me in Jerusalem for the 50th anniversary of the meeting between Pope Paul VI and Ecumenical Patriarch Athenagoras, an event that wasn't just two clerics embracing each other. It was an event that marked a complete watershed in the attempts to close the schism of 1054 that divided the ancient churches of Christendom, one from another. So, I mean, obviously, he was saying, we have more ecumenical work to do if we're ever going to be able to stand at an altar together. Meet me in Jerusalem, and let's see what we can do to get to the next step. And that was the announced reason by the Pope for why he was there. And all of that led up to an amazing event at the end of his visit in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the amazing yet also bitterly divided sanctuary where six different ancient churches fight over their turf inside that ancient building, which is not the original Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but another one built on the site. And yet that event, that remarkable ecumenical prayer service and the words they spoke there and the symbolism of that event didn't make it, unless I missed it, into any of the major papers. The Associated Press, however, did dedicate an entire report to that event and, I would argue, got about 90% of it right.
So you're not going to quibble on the details there when it comes to the AP coverage. What is this a symptom of when it comes to how the Pope is covered in general? It's not every day. I mean, what I hear you saying is it's not every day that a Pope goes and meets with an Orthodox patriarch.
Yeah.
And has this kind of explicit conversation you mentioned in your column, symbolic gestures that scream at a mutual regard between these two religious leaders that speaks volumes for their entire the division there. But what is it about coverage of the Pope that this serves as a kind of glaring symptom?
Well, part of it is because the Vatican is a state, the Vatican is a world player, etc., and we're dealing with, you know, the shepherd of 1.2 billion people or something like that. That makes it important. Yet when that shepherd meets with someone who is at least the first among equals symbolic leader of another 600 million people, you put them together, that's almost 2 billion believers in the world. You would think that the third, fourth, or fifth meeting between these people in 1,000 years would be considered fairly important. The point I made earlier is how I would restate it again. What we're seeing here is yet another example, a prime example, of how the press basically says religion is not a part of real life. Religion is not why people really do things. It's there It's symbolic. We get to take pretty pictures of it. But we all know he's really there to try to show that he has power as a statesman that the president, say, can't, or he can bring them together. He can help make peace in the Middle East. This is all about him wanting to show political clout. That's why he really was in Jerusalem. Nothing having to do with perhaps reuniting the two largest Christian churches in the world.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, more with him on media coverage of Pope Francis' trip to the Middle East. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Garfield, New Jersey. Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida. St. John's Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Unionville, Michigan. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Beverly Hills, California. Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. St. John's Lutheran, Sayville, New York. Apostles Lutheran, Melrose Park, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Elizabeth, Colorado. Grace Lutheran, Strasburg, Illinois. And Bethel Lutheran, Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Imagine SteadfastLutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub. Your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm, so check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. HigherThings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Well, the title of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May says it all. I am not afraid. Demon possession and spiritual warfare can be a fearful topic to many, but if you explore what the Bible has to say in actual instances of spiritual warfare done right, you can say it too. I am not afraid. That's the Book of the Month for May, and you can find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask for I Am Not Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. We're talking about media coverage of the trip of Pope Francis to the Middle East. Terry Mattingly, founder and editor of GetReligion.org, is our guest. Terry, before the break, you were talking about the misstep that much of the media made when covering this story. Is that why you say that the best thing they can do is to listen and report on what the Pope actually says when he makes trips like these?
Yeah, and then also, I mean, once again, there was lots of very interesting and important symbolism here. And there's church politics as well. I'll freely admit that. This particular ecumenical patriarch is the leader of a tiny, endangered church in Turkey, while the real power in modern Orthodoxy, which is my own church, is in Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church is way larger and more powerful at this moment. So, to some degree, did it matter that he was there? Yes, it did. But does he speak for all of Orthodoxy? No, he doesn't. Might it have been good to dedicate one paragraph to the fact that it's also important what Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church, thinks of this gathering and what their view of Rome is? Yeah, of course that's very important. Meanwhile, the last three popes have begun crawling out on a very interesting high wire where they have started referring to themselves, as Francis did again. he referred to the papacy, again, as the Bishop of Rome, which all the Orthodox would acknowledge him as the Bishop of Rome. He also referred to himself as the Patriarch of the West, and Benedict had done this, and John Paul, now St. John Paul II, had done this as well. What does it mean when he says he's the Patriarch of the West? Well, it could mean that he's saying that he only will claim governing universal power over the West, which might mean that the Pope would return to his role as the first among equals of the patriarchs, but would not claim ruling primacy over the churches of the East. If that's the case, I think you see Orthodoxy willing to accept reunion, which would be the biggest story in Christianity in maybe like a millennium.
How would go into some detail, if you would. How would that go over with what can be argued is a pretty deeply divided Orthodoxy? Who would be the first to say, maybe the schism is actually over?
Well, it could lead to divisions within Orthodoxy while that's worked out. But there's going to be a massive global meeting of the Orthodox patriarchs, at least they're supposed to be, about a year from now, and I'm sure this will be one of the subjects that's on the table, as well as kind of negotiating a better state of peace between Istanbul and Moscow. There, I mean, they've got issues beginning with the church in Ukraine, you know, and other places. The Orthodox have their own things to work out. My point here, though, is that the Pope said he went to Jerusalem because of this meeting. At this meeting, he moved closer to redefining the papacy, or he said that it's possible to do so in the modern era, which he said in his sermon at Holy Sepulchre. Important things were said about this other event. The question is whether you believe that religious event affecting, like I said, about 2 billion believers and 1,000 years of history. The issue is whether you think that's as important as another potential small move in the ongoing story of relationships between Israel and Palestine.
If someone were to sit down and write a biography of the late 20th, early 21st century popes, they would have to acknowledge and tell their stories as men. Wouldn't they have to acknowledge what isn't acknowledged in by default in a lot of this press coverage, that these are men who are fundamentally motivated by religious concerns, by matters of the faith?
Well, it's especially true when you get about a decade or two down the road and the church itself begins to look back at a pope's life. Now, we've just been through an extraordinary situation with Pope John Paul II, in that even at his funeral, the crowd was chanting, "Saint now." In other words, recognizing that for the late 20th century, you know, from the Nazis to the communists to everything, that here was this massive figure of the late 20th century in the life of John Paul II. So we've re-examined John Paul's life with its strengths and its weaknesses very quickly. I mean, and there's the horror and the tragedy of his failure to act on the clerical sex crimes issue. Yet at the same time, there's his role behind the scenes in the stunning reshaping of Europe into a post-communist era without a single shot being fired. We're going to learn more and more about that. And when we do, we're going to find out that it was not mere statecraft, but once again, it was his understanding of the religious convictions of people in Poland, and his understanding of those people, and his understanding of the spiritual side of Eastern Europe, and his belief ultimately in the dignity of mankind and humanity and the individual person from natural conception to natural death in the culture of life, as he would say. We're going to find that all of that runs together and connects his life. And, of course, all of that is doctrine, not politics.
Can you give me your thoughts on maybe what's a sidebar to the story or the lack of coverage of the story here when it comes to the Pope and the leaders of Orthodoxy? And that is, in the media, the relative obscurity of Orthodoxy. I mean, it can't just be that their names are difficult to pronounce. We just don't read about them.
Well, that's true, and part of that is the fault of my own church here in America, in the sense that for reasons linked to the Russian Revolution and a lot of other things, we remain kind of divided into ethnic enclaves, and the only time you see us is when people want to take pictures of people in interesting-looking gowns and headdresses at maybe marches in Washington. Orthodoxy has not really unified into a voice here in the United States. So that's part of the problem. I will also say that the ethnic Orthodox don't like the press a whole lot. I mean, there is no major press machine that's out there pushing the views of Orthodoxy on a lot of these subjects. The Orthodoxy isn't even as nearly as well developed in social media and the blogosphere as the tweeting Pope and, you know, the wide open and important world of the Catholic blogosphere. So anyway, there are reasons they don't know us, but good grief, in a situation like this, trust me, there were people there ready to talk about the religious angles of this pilgrimage. They just didn't talk to them. There was one interesting story that I talked about earlier, where I believe it was CNN, if I remember correctly, or Reuters. They did their entire report on the upcoming papal trip and even the importance between the Catholics and the Orthodox, and only interviewed Catholics. There wasn't a single quote in the story from an Orthodox source. Even when they talked about the hopes and the dreams of the Orthodox and what the Orthodox wanted out of this trip, they interviewed people at the Vatican. Just amazing.
How does that happen, Terry?
Laziness. As I said in my post, the difficulty of trying to contact the ethnic Orthodox. Not all the press spokespersons speak English, for example, in some parts of the world. But, I mean, I know it's difficult, but still, it's just basic journalism. At some point, they need to get their Rolodex out, whether it's analog or digital, and they need to get some different names in there, and they need to start ringing them up.
One other question. I want you to, we've talked a lot about the symbolic gestures, especially that took place in their meeting at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But there is a moment that you have written about recently where Francis takes the hand of Patriarch Bartholomew and kisses it. Why should that be put in not only its current but its historic context for readers?
Well, first of all, I mean, there are even Catholic bloggers right now talking about why is the Pope kissing everybody's hand? I'm not arguing this is the only hand he kissed. Even during this particular trip, he kissed the hands of some Holocaust survivors, for example, during this trip. But in the case of a person, a Catholic leader, the Pope, meeting with the Ecumenical Patriarch of Orthodox, and these are men who currently cannot stand at an altar together and do Mass, or in the East we would say divine liturgy. They are out of communion. Yet, there's a reason that people kiss the hands of priests in ancient churches. It's because they handle the bread and wine in the consecration. He kissed that hand to show respect as a priest, one priest to another, and that was significant. Also, 500 years earlier, the Ecumenical Patriarch had been forced to kiss the feet of a pope in subservience when they met before. A little bit of change.
If that change actually took place, just prognosticate for me, if you would. If there were, as you suggested before, perhaps with some deep struggle within Orthodoxy, a willingness to say the Pope takes his place among first among equals or something along those lines, or as the Bishop of Rome, fully acknowledging the equality of the other bishoprics out there, how should the media cover that particular story?
I have no clue. When you throw in the fact that Moscow will be involved in all of that, they'll try to cover it. And when they do, and when they have the Vatican experts sitting there, on the sets in Rome and wherever these rites occur, if they occur, boy, they better have some articulate, funny, colorful Orthodox people lined up right next to them to do their share of the talking. If not, well, I mean, some of us just may have to get very, very mad.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
Folks, let's review just today's lineup of issues, etc. We started out talking about the UN claim of torture against the Vatican. Lee Casey, an attorney in Washington, D.C., was our guest. We talked Christian marriage with Pastor John Rosendahl, a Mars Hill and Calvinism update with Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith. We talked about Islamic honor killings with Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, and just now, Terry Mattingly on media coverage of the Pope. Now, if you appreciate the expert guests and the wide variety of topics that we cover here daily, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. For any size donation during the Easter season before Pentecost Sunday, June the 8th, we'll send you a CD of two of my sermons, one on the resurrection of Christ and the other on the Old Testament book of Job. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues, etc. Send it to Issues, etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. That's Issues, etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind during the 50 days of Easter. Tomorrow, we'll talk about Christ in the Old Testament with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.